Hey folks, this is Rabbi David Foreman, and I am jumping in here, taking over your Into the Verse feed, because I'm excited to share with you a brand new first episode of a brand new season of a different podcast, my flagship podcast, A Book Like No Other, a special Purim edition. This is going to take the format of a conversation with my close friend and learning partner, Emmanuel Shalev. And I'm going to be looking at the Book of Esther through a very unusual prism, the story of the Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil. And I'll tell you that what was most startling for me was that this really very sophisticated intertextual reading of the Megillah, it actually has really very down-to-earth implications that really matter for how you and I conduct our most important relationships every single day. This very first episode of this season, it's really a tantalizing taste of what's to come. If you want the rest of the episodes, you need to go to the Aleph Beta website to listen to them. And just a reminder, Aleph Beta is a membership site. If you're not a member yet, I have got a hack for you. Starting this Monday, March 11th, 2024, Aleph Beta will be giving all new users an opportunity to sign up for a free trial. It's going to give you unlimited access to hundreds of hours of content on Aleph Beta. It's all for free during that free trial. And as part of that, you'll get a chance to listen to the full season of this podcast. Just go there and sign up for that free trial. One more thing, if you like listening to audio in your friendly, familiar podcast feed, once you join Aleph Beta, you'll get your very own link so that you can listen to this podcast right
hey,
in
Emu,
your favorite
so Purim
podcast
is
app.
Right around
anyway,
the
without
corner,
any further ado, here is
Megillah
that first episode, BLNO Purim edition.
Rabbi Foreman is
have
a liar. We have him on tape. Today is August the 30th. Purim is not around the corner, but I'll keep up this farce and pretend that I'm interested in the Megillah in August.
Well, Emu, from the listener's point of view, Purim is indeed around the corner. And from my point of view, I'm always interested in the Megillah. So it kind of works from a certain point of view, as Obi-Wan Kenobi is fond of saying.
Welcome to A Book Like No Other Purim Edition. A Book Like No Other is a product of Aleph Beta and made possible through the very generous support of Shari and Nathan Lindenbaum. Thank you, Shari and Nathan. Hi, I'm Emu Shalev, and each season on this podcast, I'm joined by my teacher, friend, and generally very honest man, Rabbi David Foreman, to explore a Torah text of his choice. On the docket for this season, the Book of Esther.
So let me unburden myself to you a little bit when it comes to the Book of Esther. I wrote a book about Esther called The Queen You Thought You Knew. And, you know, it was a lot of fun writing that book. And I've enjoyed watching people's reactions to it, which generally is pretty great. And yet, I vividly remember this email that I got a couple years back. Somebody was really mad with my book.
Was it my mom?
It wasn't your mom. Your mom is pretty gentle about the book. It was actually somebody who was so upset that they had written a letter to Rotzvi Hirsch Weinreb, who was the executive CEO of the OU, demanding that he retract his approbation for my book.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty harsh. So what problem could they possibly have had with The Queen You Thought You Knew?
The problem was that he couldn't figure out where God was in the book. He says, Foreman's book does a great job of analyzing all of the political derring do and paints Esther as this brilliant tactician and Mordechai as this brilliant tactician. And if you consider political success high intrigue, then that's really great. But where is God in the book? And, you know, I believe to some extent, Rabbi Weinreb's response was is that your critique isn't really a critique of Foreman's book. Your critique is a critique of the Book of Esther, because God's name famously doesn't appear in the Book of Esther, right? But somehow the critique of this fellow sort of always stuck in my mind, which is like, when you look back at the Book of Esther, what really is the message of that book? Is the message similar to, you know, Machiavelli's The Prince, which is that you've got to be pretty clever when you take to the political stage to speak in large terms about this? How do we come to grips with this idea that God isn't overtly there in the book. How do we struggle with that? What is the book sort of meant to teach us?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you're phrasing it that way. It's almost as if, like, if I wanted to study a religious book, there are so many religious books that I can pull off my shelf. And pulling off Esther, it's a great read, a real page turner. Why did Esther do this? That seemed like a crazy thing for the king to do. And like, you forget that actually it's one of the books of Tanakh.
Right.
Right? Like, what's the payoff here? Like, I'm really proud of, you know, my ancestors, Mordechai and Esther. But if I'm trying to grow, you know, maybe I'm better off reading one of the other books on my shelf. Maybe I should read some Pirkei Avos or study some Talmud. Why this book? What is the grand spiritual moral of the Book of Esther?
And, you know, I know the classic answer to this, right? The classic answer mm-hmm. to this is, well, God doesn't appear overtly in this book, but boy, is he behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. He's pulling all the strings. And I do agree that there is some comfort in that thought. And I mm-hmm. do agree that the book can be seen to have meaning from that. But I still get back to that original question, what are we supposed to learn from this in terms of our lives? In other words, to me, the book then becomes a theological meditation, perhaps, mm-hmm. on the sort of ways in which God is there behind the scenes. And it's almost like, so maybe I get a peek into God's world. But typically, what we look to in Tanakh is not getting a peek into God's world. Tanakh, generally speaking, is not the story of God. It's the story of God's interaction with us, or better, the story of our interaction with God. It's what are we supposed to do as we live in connection with God? And so what's the book telling me about that?
Right.
So I want to suggest that there's another side to the Megillah that we don't often see, in which there is something moral, something very practical and important that we need to learn to live our lives well. And if we read the story correctly, we should be able to get there.
I just want to say it in one more way. A Reb Foreman loves to put courses this way, so I'll say it this way. You've been reading the Megillah wrong your entire life. You've never extracted the morals from the Megillah. So if you don't keep listening to this season of A Book Like No Other, you will continue as an ignoramus, completely detached from the spiritual takeaways of the Megillah. So you must listen if you're ever to have a dream of celebrating Purim correctly.
Yeah, well, that definitely sounds like me, Emu. You really channeled me there. I can hear the inner me clapping to that black and white notion of reading the book. Well, I'm much more into shades of gray than that, right? I think there's some real nuance here. But I'm going to delight in showing you that nuance. And I don't think we were the first ones to stumble upon it. I think the rabbis had this up their sleeve as well. They've got a whole Masechta in the Talmud, Tractate Megillah, that deals with Megillat Esther. And reading behind the scenes of some of the comments they make there and some of the comments they make in the Medrash, I think we can perceive a launch pad towards what I think the rabbis' understandings of the moral foundations of this document really is.
I was teasing Rabbi Foreman earlier, but he did seem to be making a big claim. Not only is the Megillah this great political drama, not only is it a sneak peek into God's providence, but it also has some other kind of grand moral and spiritual takeaway that will change how I live today. I have to say, though, when I brought it down to earth, his question did make a lot of sense. I've heard people ask, where do you find God in the Megillah, like, my whole life? But this was a new spin on that classic question. He seemed to be asking, not where do we find God, but where do we find godliness? Where do we find in the Book of Esther direction on bringing God and his ideals into our lives through our actions? After all, isn't that how we often try to bring God into the world? So we had our goal, this grand moral vision. What? I still get to tease him about it. But Rabbi Foreman had also begun to share his game plan. First stop, those midrashim, those statements of the sages that he mentioned. But let me warn you, at face value, these midrashim, they're going to seem like they're not related to Rabbi Foreman's question at all. They're just going to seem like a bunch of rabbis making really wild claims about the Book of Esther. So in this episode, we're going to go through the three midrashim Rabbi Forman wants to show me. In the episodes to come, we're going to dive deep into the biblical text itself to see if we can find a deeper impetus for the sage's odd claims. We're going to follow the sage's clues to the Megillah, but also to another destination in Tanakh. It's a journey that's going to illuminate the Megillah in some really surprising and unexpected ways, and hopefully help to bring out the godliness hidden in the human action of this story. Okay, so let's get to Medrash number one. This is from Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, and it has to do with a minor character in the Megillah, Charvona. You remember Charvona, right? No? Maybe you remember him from the song. The sages immortalized Charvona in song because he plays a tiny but important role in the Megillah. After Esther tells Ahasuerus that Haman has targeted her people, Charvona, one of the king's servants, pops up and adds that Haman has also built a gallows on which to hang the king's personal friend Mordechai. But actually, according to our Medrash, Charvona really didn't need a song to immortalize him, because he was already immortal to begin with.
The sages say that Charvona was in fact an angel. Charvona was Elio Anavi, basically. Elio is famously the prophet that never dies, that goes up into heaven in a fiery cavalcade, and in Midrashic literature will sometimes make his presence known on earth. And Charvona is not a real person, the sages tell us. Charvona is a cloaked Elijah, a cloaked angel.
Now, the Megillah is as absent of angels and Elijah as it is of God's name. So this Midrash really seemed to be coming out of nowhere. Where do you even begin to unpack a Medrash like this? Well, just to get our foot in the door, Rabbi Forman wanted to start by looking for what he calls the trigger. The trigger for a Medrash is some kind of small local problem or anomaly in the text that the sages seem to be responding to. A literary hole or repeated word, something like that. The trigger alone won't explain every seemingly imaginative leap the sages go on to take in a given Medrash, but it's a way to peel back one layer of mystery and begin to see the text through the sage's eyes. So was there a trigger for our Medrash? Rabbi Forman had a hunch that there was, and it had to do with something very odd going on in the text just before Charvona appears. We flipped open our Tanakhs to read this scene together.
So here is the scene in which Charvona appears. It is in the Book of Esther, chapter 7. The queen has had this series of banquets, where she keeps on telling the king that eventually I'm going to tell you what it is that I want. The king keeps on saying, just tell me, you know, half the kingdom and it's yours. And finally, Esther makes her dramatic reveal. She says, you know, if I found favor in the king's eyes, please give me my life. That's all I want. My life, the life of my nation, because we've been sold off to be destroyed. Could you please help us out? And Ahasuerus is shocked. And he says, Miuzev Ezehu. Who could that possibly be that wants to destroy you in this way, my fair queen? And Esther says, Ish tsar va'oyev, Haman hara hazeh. It's that terrible Haman over there. And Haman shrinks away in fear. Now, Emu, if you didn't know the rest of the Megillah, if you would have to surmise what happens here, what do you think the most likely thing to happen at this point would be?
King would be like, I'm horrified. Let's get rid of this Haman guy. I'm so sorry that this ever happened to you.
Exactly. And that's the end of Haman. Haman is carted away, arrested, never to appear again, to die in a dungeon, or to be hanged at the next possible moment, right? That's what you would expect. Strangely, that's not what happens. The king does get really mad, but he doesn't impetuously do away with Haman.
Yeah, he goes for a stroll in the garden,
right? A stroll in the garden, right? He decides it's time to take a walk around, see if he can calm down, which is crazy because if there's one thing you know about the king...
he's the king of impulsivity. And he's
totally...
I got to calm down right now.
Exactly.
I've been in therapy.
Exactly.
It's time to try out some of my tools.
What is that about? It's like, you know, that notion in therapy, always take 5 seconds to think something over, never act in haste. That's not Ahasuerus, but now is the one time he decides to really give it a whirl. The worst possible news for Esther. This is not the moment you want the king to think things over, right? If he thinks a little too carefully, he may realize that, you know, there's some threads here that don't add up. Esther has been sort of surreptitiously hinting to the possibility of a romantic dalliance, at least the way Rashi reads it, between her and Haman. She keeps on inviting them to these private banquets. The king can't sleep thinking about Haman being invited to this private banquet just between her and him. Has this all been a plot? Is she trying to con him? Like, you don't want the king to start really thinking about it, but that's what he does. And it gives Haman crucial time to appeal for his life. So he goes and he literally begs Esther for his life because he sees he's in trouble. What happens next? The king comes back and he finds Haman nofel al hamita asher Esther aleha. He sees Haman falling on the couch and the king says, Hagam lichboshet amalka imi babayit. Now you actually want to seduce, you want to conquer the queen with me right here in this house. But here's the interesting thing. If you stop right there, the king still does not say off with his head. It's not like the next verse is, and take him away. There's something holding him back. And it's weird because the king has promised her half the kingdom and it's yours. I'll do anything. And he doesn't, right? And it's like, what's going on? And at that point, enter Harvona, this minor character. Vayomer Harvona, echad min asari simlufi ha-melech, one of the eunuchs, one of the servants of the king, came before the king and said, by the way, king, just wanted to let you know, gam hinei ha-eitz asher asa Haman le-Mordechai, asher diber tov al ha-melech. You know, that guy, Mordechai, the one who, you know, saved the king from the assassination plot, who you had riding through the streets and everyone said, all hail Mordechai. Turns out that Haman's got this gallows, this tree in his backyard, to hang Mordechai on. It's right there, and it's 50 yamot high. And at that point, the king says, a tree to hang Mordechai? That's the last straw. Teluhu alav. Hang Haman on that tree. And so Harvona is the guy who delivers the knockout blow.
So you're saying, what do you really need to have happen here to get rid of Haman? You need Harvona, this minor character, to basically add his final blow to things, and then the king says the two words we've been waiting for him to say the entire time, which is hang him.
Exactly.
And you're saying that Harvona, that minor character, is none other than Elijah the prophet.
Well, I'm not saying it.
The sages are saying it.
But now the question is, nice theory, sages, do you have any evidence? Like, is it just something they know from tradition? Is it something they hope is true? Is it something they theorize is true? Like when I was growing up in yeshiva, something like that, you'd say, well, they had a Kabbalah, there was some sort of tradition, goes back a long time, right? Maybe, right? Maybe. But it's also possible they figured it out, right? How did they figure this out? That Harvona was, in fact, an angelic force.
In other words, this medrash really isn't coming out of absolutely nowhere. We can see what triggered it. It's weird how Ahasuerus hesitates to punish Haman, and how some random servant, Harvona, is the one who finally convinces him to take action. It's like the text is begging us to do a double take and say, hey, who's this Harvona fellow? Is there more to him than meets the eye? But to then leap to filling that hole with, oh, he must be an angel. It's a lovely idea, but it does seem like quite a leap. So are the sages relying on tradition, or are they seeing maybe even more in this text that we are not? So hold on to that thought. For now, we're moving on to Medrash number 2. This one's from the Gemara, Tractate Megillah, page 16a. And it's actually commenting on that same scene we were talking about, when Esther confronts the king. This time, the sages are picking up on a tiny detail in that story and really running with it. It's actually one of the details we also found odd, how Ahasuerus just gets up and goes for a walk.
Esther has just pointed out Haman, and the king, rather than saying off with his head, decides it's a good time to go for a walk in the garden. And The sages are speculating for us. They're telling us what happened during that walk. We know nothing from the Megillah about what happened during the walk. We just know that it happened. He went on a walk. The sages fill in the walk with something almost comedic. Here's what they say. They start with the verse that tells us that the king went on a walk. That verse tells us the king was very angry when he got up and went on that walk. Hamelach kam b'chamato mimishtayayin. The king got up in anger from the feast and bolted out the door to his garden. And then it says, Hamelach shav miginat abitan, and the king returned from the garden. So the structure of the verse is the same. Hamelach kam mimishteh hayayin, Hamelach shav miginat abitan, and the sages infer from this that the nature of his return was the same as the nature of his getting up. Just like getting up, the king was really angry, so too on his return, he was angry. And as you see in the text itself, the king was just as enraged upon his return as he was when he got up, which is counterintuitive.
It sounds like the sages are asking a really smart question, which I would not have noticed, which is, he's going on the walk to calm down.
Yeah.
So then you'd expect this character, right? If I'm writing a story, you say that the character went on a walk to calm down and then he returned calmer, right? But that doesn't appear to be what happens with Ahasuerus. She's not like, Esther, look, you know I love you, but Haman and I, we're really tight. Like, we've been friends for a long time, and, you know, I got some clear mind on my walk, but that's not what happens, right?
Right. The sages are just pointing out the obvious truth, which is, like, from his statement that he chooses to look upon Haman with such a jaundiced eye, he sees a guy literally pleading with his life, and the only thing you can think of is that he's trying to seduce his wife, is obviously somebody who's still pretty enraged, so the walk didn't help. Right? Mm-hmm. So why didn't the walk help? I mean, he's out in the beautiful trees. He's got 15 minutes to smell the beautiful spring air. So the sages say because something happened on the walk that kept him enraged. Turns out, Azol v'ashkach l'malachei ha'shareis, he actually encounters some angels. Now, he didn't know they were angels. Idmi le'kagavre, because they appeared as regular people. So he just encountered some people, little did he realize that they were cloaked angels. What were the angels doing? Well, he went on a walk to enjoy the trees, right? That's why you go on a walk. What were the angels doing? Ka'akri li lanein du bustana. They're sitting there, literally digging up the trees of the king's garden. He's like going there, and there's like this whole work crew with their, you know, yellow work tape setting up like construction zone. They've got the big construction equipment, and they're just cutting down one tree after another. That he's sitting there trying to enjoy the trees. It's like, you know, when you go on the New Jersey Turnpike, you're going like a mile, you're going a mile in an hour because they've closed down five lanes, and they've decided that this is a great time for construction. Well, the palace work crew has decided this is the time to completely destroy his garden.
It sounds worse than that. It sounds like what I'm picturing is like a Zen garden, you know, quiet beautiful walk with the fountain in the middle. And people are pulling up, right, all the beautifully cultivated
cherry trees. And like, there's no Zen, there's nothing, there's just jackhammers, there's trees being destroyed. And the king is like, Amr Luhu, Mayuv Daihu, what in the world are you doing here? Right? Amrule, and they said, oh no, we are absolutely supposed to be here, king. We can show you our work orders. And they show him their work orders, and lo and behold, who are they signed by? Haman. Pakdinan Haman. We were commanded to do this by Haman. And that is what kept the king in a rage when he returned. That's what the sages say. Now, where in the world did they get the story from? It sounds farcical. It sounds like the kind of thing that would be in a Yeshiva Purim play. What are they trying to tell us?
So as with our last medrash, we can identify the trigger in this medrash too, that narrative hole that the sages are trying to fill in. It's curious that we're told that Ahasuerus goes on this mysterious walk and then comes back from the walk in the exact same mood that he left. Like, the walk had no effect on him. But also, like our first medrash, just because we can identify the problem that the sages are responding to, that doesn't mean we can make heads or tails of the way they solve the problem. Honestly, it was starting to seem like the sages just like to throw angels at every literary hole in the Book of Esther. The unknown dude? He's an angel. The mysterious walk? The king met angels. But what about Ahasuerus' walk in the text itself is actually screaming out to us, oh, this must have been the work of celestial gardeners. All right, so last but not least, we are moving on to Medrash number 3. And this one's a little bit different than the last two,
because in this case, the sages aren't going to be riffing off of a textual problem in the Book of Esther itself. Instead, they're going to be playing what will probably seem like kind of an odd party game, a game where the sages ask, are the characters from Megillas Esther hinted to anywhere in the five books of Moses? At least this one has nothing to do with angels, though it does have to do with a kind of angelic paradise, the Garden of Eden.
So the rabbis have this supposition that the main characters of the Megillah are hinted to in the five books of Moses itself. It's a very anachronistic idea because the five books of Moses are written hundreds of years before the Megillah, so how would they hint to events in the Megillah? But the rabbis are not concerned about that. They ask about each of the major characters, ex mina Torah minayin. Where do we find a remez, a hint to the following characters? So, for example, Haman. Haman, of course, is the arch-villain of the Megillah, the one who wants to single-handedly wipe out all the Jews of the realm in one blood-soaked day in the month of Adar. And the sages ask, Haman min Atara minayin, where do we find Haman in the five books of Moses? Where do we have a hint to his name? And they take us to this verse really early in the Torah. It's the moment where Adam, having eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, is hiding behind a tree, naked. God approaches him in the garden and has a question for him. Adam, where are you? Where'd you go? Adam is like, well, I was hiding because I was naked. And God's next point is, me yigid lecha ki aramata. One second, who told you you were naked? Hamin ha'etz asher tziviticha levilticha chol menu achalta. Have you perhaps eaten from that tree that I told you not to eat from? Now that word, have you perhaps, is hamin. Hamin, the hey, is that sort of rhetorical question. Min is from. Have you indeed eaten from that tree? So the sages say that hey mem nun there, hamin, that's Haman.
To spell this out, literally, Hamin and Haman share identical letters, he, mem, nun. That's what the sages seem to be picking up on. Like, if you just skim the Torah text with your eyes, Haman's name seems to randomly appear in the Garden of Eden story. Only, it did seem so random.
Emu, if we were playing Family Feud, you know the rules of Family Feud, right? It, survey says, the goal is to give the most likely answer that a survey of 100 people would give an answer to. So if I would say to you, Emu, give me your top five possibilities for Haman min Atara minayin, Emu, where would you rank Hamin ha'etz as a reference to Haman?
Would get the big, That's right. Zero people did not show up on the board.
Right, it doesn't sound like Haman, it's vowelized differently, it doesn't seem to obviously connect to Haman. If you had to associate Haman with one character and one character only from the Tree of Knowledge story, which would it be?
The snake.
The snake, obviously. I mean, Haman is so snake-like, but the snake isn't even involved at that point. It's just a dialogue between Adam and God. No snake. So it's not like we're connecting Haman to the snake. We're connecting Haman to what God said to Adam. What's that about?
So once again, we can see what's triggering the sages. There's an obvious textual connection. These two identically spelled words, Haman and Hamin. But does the connection go beyond that? Are the sages seeing something that we are not? Are they seeing something that tells them that Charvona was an angel? Are they seeing something that tells them Ahasuerus ran into a team of angels in disguise on his walk in the garden? And are they seeing something that tells them that Haman, who was certainly no angel, was hinted to way back in that angelic paradise, the Garden of Eden, when God first confronts Adam about eating from the tree? Rabbi Foreman's hunch was yes. In all these cases, the rabbis were seeing something that led them to make these seemingly fantastic and outlandish claims. And not just that, but that in all three cases, they were seeing the same thing.
What I want to suggest to you when we come back and get a chance to learn together again is that the sages saw one thing, and they pulled on a thread. And as you pulled on that thread, more and more stuff seems to reveal itself. And all of these strange things that they're saying are just different ways of talking about what that thread reveals to us. And the very first thread that I want to come back to you next time when we reconvene is Haman min Atara minayin, this notion that Haman appears way back in the very first story of the Torah. It's almost as if the sages are saying that the very end of the Hebrew Bible, this moment at the end of the exile, the end of the 70 years when the Jews are in Persia, subject to this intense genocidal decree, that moment in history, that moment of the Megillah, somehow connects to the very first moments in biblical history, the moment when God approached Adam, and it's like, what were you doing when you were eating the tree? The sages, in a way, are bringing together the beginning of the Hebrew Bible with the end of the Hebrew Bible in what I think is a majestic attempt to say, you want to know what this book is about, this whole thing, this thousands and thousand page thing called the Bible, all the way from Genesis through Esther and Ezra and Nehemiah. We're not done with the story of the tree of knowledge in Genesis. It takes us all the way through. We're done with it at the very end. We're done with it in the book of Esther. Haman min Atara minayin. And as you begin to pull on that thread, everything else slowly starts to reveal itself.
I know I mocked Rabbi Foreman at the beginning of this episode for making what seemed like grand claims, but now he really was saying something that felt big. Not only is the Megillah more than a political drama, and not only is it more than a comforting peek into God's hidden hand, not only is it a book with an even deeper moral and spiritual takeaway lying in wait for us to uncover, but now he was taking all of that one step further. If you really want to understand the takeaways of this book, he seemed to be saying, you can't even think about it as an isolated book. The moral Esther is meant to teach us may actually be one of the sweeping morals we're meant to learn from the grand narrative of the entire Bible. And all these midrashim, these strange statements of the sages, they might be hints to help us see the book of Esther in the context of that grand narrative, to see this book, one of the last books of Tanakh, this book in which God is seemingly hidden, as the culmination of events that began way back in the very beginning of Tanakh, in the Garden of Eden, when God was anything but hidden, when God first walked among us. It was indeed a grand promise, but it was still puzzling. What could Esther have to do with Eden? And maybe even more puzzling, how were the rabbi's tale of cosmic beings and comedy sketches going to help this whole epic connection come to light? This season of A Book Like No Other was recorded by Rabbi David Foreman and me, Imu Shalev. It was produced by Tikva Hecht and Beth Lesh, with additional editing done by Sarah Penso. Our audio engineer is Hilary Gutman. A Book Like No Other's managing producer is Adina Blaustein, and our senior producer is Tikva Hecht. A Book Like No Other is a product of Aleph Beta and made possible through the very generous support of Shari and Nathan Lindenbaum. Thank you, Shari and Nathan, and thank you all for listening.